Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Foundations. Come on in and take a seat. Really glad to see you here on this rainy Wednesday night. We have a couple things stacked up against us tonight. On the one hand, of course, you know it, the weather is not terribly conducive, but in addition, I and about 50 of our members, half of which come to this class on Wednesday night, just got in like 45 minutes ago on a bus from the Ark up in Kentucky. So most of those folks went home, as you can imagine, because we've been on the bus for hours and hours. And I ran home to shower, because I probably stunk having been on the bus all those hours, and threw something on, only to realize I am wearing almost the exact same outfit as our guest speaker tonight. He is a thinner, better looking version of me, our student pastor, Blake Maxwell. Let me say a couple things about Blake before I pray and invite him up. Blake's been on our staff now for four years. He's married to his lovely wife, Holly, who is seated in the back. They have five going on six children. God has been very kind to this dear couple. He is a blessing to this church. Blake did his schooling in Liberty University as well as Southern Seminary up in Louisville, Kentucky. He is a pastor. He's not just a student guy. He genuinely is a pastor. He'll serve us well tonight as he continues our series here in Foundations tonight. So why don't you join me as we pray? Let's ask God to speak in and through him, and then we'll begin. Let's pray together. Father in heaven, I thank you that you have men and women in this church who are hungry for your word and will come back on a Wednesday night, even in adverse conditions. I pray, Lord, that you would speak through Blake, that you would help him to rightly divide your word, and that our faith would be strengthened. And we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. My doppelganger, Blake Maxwell.
Excellent. Good deal. Yeah, it's kind of interesting, you know, if I could grow a beard, which I can't, and gain a... I can't. He definitely has that on me for sure. So maybe later we can take some pictures, you can play a game, who wore it better, and we'll see who came out as the winner. Anyway, it's good to see you guys tonight. Glad to be with you in this room this evening. It's been a while since I've been with you. I think the last time was probably in pastor's class, which is maybe might have been a year and a half, 2 years ago at this point. But tonight, we're going to continue forward in our study of the Old Testament. Pastor Clint led us through the book of Ruth last week. This week, we'll pick up with the book of 1 Samuel. So take your Bibles, open up to 1 Samuel, and we'll get there. We'll get there. So as you're turning open to 1 Samuel, you have to know that 1 Samuel was originally written as really one big book with 1 and 2 Samuel combined. It wasn't until the Septuagint actually divided the book, and actually we have two books as a result of that. So it's been two books ever since. When you think about the dating and the timing of when this book actually came into being, it was around 960 BC or so. It was written approximately 100 years after the events actually took place. So if you look at the time frame of when everything took place in the book of 1 Samuel, you would see that it was somewhere between 1100 and 1000 BC. So someone's looking back and writing in retrospect what has happened to record these events in 960. So that's kind of what you have when you're looking at the book of 1 Samuel. When it comes to the authorship, there are a lot of debates as to who actually wrote this book. Some people would say that Samuel wrote the book himself. Kind of controversial in some ways, though. You get towards the end of the book, you end up seeing that Samuel actually dies. So he's not the one writing about his own death, which would be kind of awkward, right? So you have probably some disciples of Samuel that actually wrote the book. Samuel probably wrote some of it with him, but it wasn't solely Samuel. So we would say that this book is probably written by someone that is anonymous. So what you end up seeing is that Samuel will serve for us as the last judge for Israel, and that he would anoint the first two kings of Israel. So you have him serving as this judge that would serve the purpose of carrying us over from the time of the judges all the way to the time of the kings. And he would anoint Saul and he would anoint David as kings. Now it's easy as we look at a book like this, it's easy to look at this as just history, but we have to understand that even though this was written years and years and years ago, there is such rich application that you can find in this book even today. And in fact, you could even say that this book is in some ways a mirror to the society that we're living in today. So, I mean, a quick glance at the book and you'll see that there's hardship that's faced here. There's adultery that happens here. There's power struggles that you see in the book of 1 Samuel. There's war. There's tensions. There's all kinds of corruption that's present. There's evil all across the place. So you could even say that 1 Samuel is a mirror of what we're seeing today in our society. It kind of gives us this idea as we look at this book in totality that there's really nothing new under the sun, that what we're experiencing and walking through today differs in no way than what we've seen in years past, only that we just have more advancement in technology as opposed to where they were then. But also you should know that as we're looking at the sum total of 1 Samuel and even 2 Samuel, you see that there's a ton of chaos, a ton of tragedy, a ton of hardship, but in the midst of all of that, in the midst of all of that difficulty, you find a glimmer of hope. You see that there's someone that kind of rises up out of nowhere, this man that would be anointed king, that would be David, that kind of gives us this understanding and glimmer of hope to know that even in the midst of hardship, there is salvation that comes that points us to King Jesus. So that's kind of what we see when we look at the dating and the authorship of the book. Let's go down your page and talk just a little bit about the purpose of 1 Samuel. Now, I think that you could break this purpose down into three different ways. The first purpose that you would see in 1 Samuel is that this is really to serve a time to show us the history of Israel in the land of Canaan from the time of the judges to the time of the kings, kind of like we mentioned before. It's to be this bridge that carries us over from this wicked time during the time of the judges to when we would have someone ruling and reigning as king in Israel. Now you know that during the time of the judges, there was nothing but wickedness across the board. In fact, you would see towards the end of Judges in chapter 21, the main problem is that there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in their own eyes. And so you saw this terrible, wicked cycle of sin over and over and over again. And so Samuel would serve the purpose of picking up the ball, taking us from this period of time, and leading us all the way to the kings. The second purpose that this book serves for us is to show us a reminder of the faithfulness of God to accomplish His divine purposes in His people and in His time. So really this book, if you look at it from chapter 1 all the way to chapter 31, you can't help but see the unbelievable faithfulness of God to accomplish His purposes. And it's incredible that He accomplishes His purposes using sinful and wicked people to do so. At times, as you look through the book, as you see the transitions from Samuel to Saul to David, you see a lot of transition happening. And it's easy to think that in the midst of all this transition that God is absent, that God is not involved. But here you find that God is working through these small minor details to accomplish His purposes and His plan. The third purpose that you can say that this book serves is ultimately to point us to King Jesus. You have David that kind of rises up towards the last third of this book that would be anointed in chapter 16. He's kind of recognized in chapter 16 that as the king that would take over after Saul. And what David does is that he points us to the true and the better king that ultimately brings us salvation. That is Jesus and Jesus alone. So those are the three purposes. It shows us the history. It shows us the faithfulness of God. And it points us to Jesus. Now, I'll throw out a couple of themes to you. So this is the outline that Pastor Clint used at Harris Campus just maybe a couple of months ago. So I want to add in a few elements to this outline. You're not going to have it written or typed out on your paper, but you can write these themes down. I think there are two themes that I want you to see as you look through the whole course of this book. And the first one is this, is that you see God's kingship. God's kingship. In fact, you can see this in 1 Samuel chapter 2, verse 10. Let that be the first verse that we look at. Take your Bibles and go to 1 Samuel chapter 2, verse 10, and we'll read this section and kind of let that show us how we see God's kingship here. This kind of happens in the midst of Hannah's prayer. We know the character Hannah. We know that she plays a significant role. In fact, we'll talk just a little bit more about her in just a few minutes. Hannah is a significant figure in this book. She is barren in chapter 1. She cries out earnestly that God would grant her a child, and God graciously grants her a child, this child Samuel that we see as the prophet and the would-be, the one that would carry us from the judges to the kings. And then in chapter 2, you see that she's praying, and she cries out in chapter 2, verse 10. She says, "The adversaries of the Lord shall be broken to pieces. Against them he will thunder in heaven. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth. He will give strength to his king and exalt the horn of his anointed. In the middle section of verse 10, she says that God will judge the earth. Who alone can judge but the king? So here she's referring to the kingship of God, God's kingship over all of the earth. Now that's going to be something that you see not just here in chapter 2, but you'll actually see this presented all the way through the end of chapter 31. Now we're talking about God's kingship. We're talking about a word that we hear all the time, and it's this word sovereignty. You guys know what sovereignty is? Sovereignty is the idea that God reigns over all things and does as he pleases with all things. There's one theologian that would even say that there's not one single speck of the human creation that is in existence that doesn't cry out, mine from Christ. Meaning that everything that is in existence is owned and operated by the Lord and the Lord alone. So you see God's kingship all throughout this book. You see it from transition to transition. You see it even working in wicked moments when it doesn't seem like God's active. You see God reigning fully on his throne. So you see God's kingship. But secondly, you see God's providence. And this kind of walks hand in hand with God's kingship. God's providence is his ability to provide for that which he has created. And this is the idea that God has had this initial plan from the very beginning to provide a way of redemption for his people. And God accomplishes that through the working of Saul, through the working of Hannah, Saul, and David. He brings about his purposes in his way. So a way that we can look at this book, we'll take a minute here in just a few seconds to look at a summary of the book altogether. But before we do that, I want to give us just a couple of hooks to hang this book on. A couple of key passages that I think will be helpful for you. So open up to 1 Samuel chapter 8, verse 6. Go there with me if you will. This will be the first section that we look at together a little bit more in depth. 1 Samuel chapter 8, verses 6 and 7. Now at this point in chapter 8, you see that Samuel has already been judging. He's already been reigning in this Israel. You see that he's serving his purpose here. He's actually getting near the end of his life in chapter 8, verse 1. In fact, it says in verse 1, when Samuel became old. So it shows us that really Samuel's near the end of his life. We don't have a whole lot mentioned about this person, Samuel. His life kind of happens in a brief instance. But in verses 6 and 7, what you end up seeing is that Israel brings before Samuel the fact that Samuel's sons are not judging and reigning properly in the land. And so he says, listen, your sons are not doing the job that they're supposed to be doing. They're pretty bad people. They're not good judges. We need something else. We need a king in Israel. And so for Samuel, like he initially takes that to the Lord and says, God, what am I supposed to do with this? And God tells them, listen, you need to instill and appoint a king that will rule over the land. And here is this idea that God is essentially allowing what he is not approving. So what you end up seeing is that they appoint this man, Saul. But here in verses 6 and 7, this is what the passage says. It says, but this thing displeased Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. And Samuel prayed to the Lord, and the Lord said to Samuel, obey the voice of the people in all that they say to you, for they were not rejected you, but they rejected me from being king over them. So here in this moment, it could have been easy for Samuel to take this personally. For them to say, like, hey, listen, we need somebody else to lead us in this place. You're not doing a good job. Your sons are not doing a good job. But here, God speaks to Samuel and says, listen, they've not rejected you, but they've rejected me. And so we should pause here and just think about this for a moment. For anybody that serves in ministry, for anybody that serves in any type of leadership position, you'll find that oftentimes rejection happens. There might be people that speak down to you. There might be people that don't agree with the way that you lead. There might be people that speak things against you that are not necessarily the kindest of things. But oftentimes we need to remember that if we're serving the Lord faithfully, then they're not rejecting us, but they're rejecting the Lord whom we serve. So this is a key verse that we need to hold on to looking at the book of 1 Samuel. Go over to chapter 13, verses 33 and 34. Chapter 13, verses 33 and 34. In chapter 13, you find that Saul has already assume the position of leadership here. He's reigning as king. He's reigning as king. And in this moment, there's this situation that kind of gets Saul in this frantic. He feels as if the Philistines are going to conquer him. He's waiting for Samuel to come and offer the sacrifice before the Lord. Saul is franticking. He's anxious. He's panicking. He's wanting to move on so he doesn't get attacked and so he doesn't get killed. This is what we see in verses 13 and 14. Now, after this begins to happen, after the Philistines begin to kind of wage war up against Israel, you end up seeing that Saul actually does the job of Samuel and offers this sacrifice unlawfully. And then as a result of that, you see in verses 13 and 14, this is what Samuel says. If I could find it, here we go. And it says, "And Samuel said to Saul, 'You have done foolishly. You've not kept the command of the Lord your God with which he has commanded you. For then the Lord would have established you your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart, and the Lord has commanded him to be prince over his people because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you.'" So here in this moment, you've got Samuel directly speaking to Saul, saying, "Listen, what you've done has been unlawful. What you have done has been disobedient in the sight of God. What you have done has not been a right thing." And so eventually, this kind of is a foreshadow that would point us to the future where Saul's reign would eventually end and David would begin to take over. Now that leads us into 1 Samuel chapter 15, verses 22 and 23. And here you kind of see the final nail in the coffin, if you will, for Saul's leadership in Israel. This is another situation, another conversation that happens between Samuel and Saul. Samuel is speaking up boldly against this guy, Saul. Samuel is going to call him out yet again because Saul, in chapter 15, has been given strict instructions from God. The instructions, what they were to really completely destroy all of the Amalekites. In fact, they were to take the king, they were to take all of the spoil, they were to really destroy everything. Nothing was to be left. And you end up seeing that Saul, because at this point he's already doing what he wants to do. He's already in this active state of rebellion. He will do whatever he wants to do. He ends up taking some of the spoil. He ends up grabbing some of the best of things so he can pad his own pockets, being disobedient to God, doing things his own way. He grabs the king of the Amalekites, this guy named Agag, takes him with him as well, doesn't listen to God. And then in verse 15, chapter 22, this is what you end up seeing Samuel say to Saul. He says, and Samuel said, has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to listen than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as the sin of divination, and presumption is as iniquity and idolatry. Because you've rejected the word of the Lord, he has also rejected you from being king." So think about that for a second. This is Samuel. In chapter 8, we see that he's an older man. Now, we're like several chapters ahead of that now at this point in chapter 15, which means that Samuel is still an older man, and he's speaking nothing but truth to this man, Saul. Now, we're going to look at Saul in just a second, but you have to know that Saul is this man that, from the outward appearance, seemed to have everything together. He was a guy that probably stood, 6'2", 6'3", 6'4", looked good, had a broad shoulder, had everything that you thought a leader should and would have. And here is Samuel, this older man, speaking truth to him, saying that your kingdom will eventually end because you've done nothing but disobedience. You've rebelled against God, and your kingdom will end. So those are three verses that you can kind of hang this entire book on. But let's take a couple of minutes here and walk through what would be a quick summary of the entirety of 1 Samuel. The way that you can break this down, I'll give you three different ways that you can look at this summary. We'll look firstly at the rise of Samuel. We'll look secondly at the rise and downfall of Saul. And then we'll look at the rise of David. So we'll look at the rise of Samuel, the rise and downfall of Saul, and then the rise of David thirdly. So let's take a look first at the rise of Samuel in chapter 1. This will carry us from chapter 1 all the way through chapter 7. So let's backtrack just a little bit, go back to chapter 1. If you want to start there, we'll highlight some of these places along the way, but I want us to be able to see just a glimpse of what this book looks like as quickly as we can. Now, we've got a lot to cover. I think we'll get through it in time. Bear with me, if you will. Let's start with chapter 1 here. Chapter 1, verse 10. You're made aware of a woman named Hannah, like we talked about just a minute ago. You find in chapter 1, verse 10, that she is a woman that has been praying for this son. In fact, you see in chapter 1, verse 10, it says that she was deeply distressed, and she prayed to the Lord, and she wept bitterly, and she vowed a vow. And she said, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your servant and remember me and not forget your servant, but will give to your servant a son, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall touch his head. She's a woman that is devoted to prayer. She's a woman that feels distress. She's a woman that feels discouragement, but in that discouragement and in that distress, in that deep depression, where's she going? She takes her concerns before the Lord. 1 Peter chapter 5, she brings her anxieties to God. And what you end up seeing is that God listens to her prayer, God answers her prayer, and grants her a child. You see this in verse 20. It says that she conceived and she called his name Samuel. So here is this man, Samuel, that comes on the scene at the end of chapter 1. And in the end of chapter 1, verse 31, you see that Hannah is faithful to do exactly what she says she's going to do. She said that if you give me a son, I'm going to give him back to you, and he will serve the Lord all his days. Verse 31 says that she really gave the child back to the Lord. She says that, you know, the children are lent from the Lord. So she gives it back to God, and we see that is the first conversation that we see that Samuel will be used serving the Lord going into chapter 2. Also, you see in chapter 1, there's a man by the name of Eli. As I was doing study through here, I'd never done too much of a deep dive into the person of Eli before, knew who he was, but found out some really interesting things here. Our pastor would even say that this guy was spiritually obtuse. He would say that he's as sharp as a marble when it comes to spiritual things. I thought that was pretty funny, right? That seems like something our pastor would say. But Eli is this guy that is serving as a priest at this moment, but really has no spiritual sharpness at all. In chapter 1, you actually see that he is watching Hannah pray. He's seeing Hannah pray at the temple. She's praying. She's calling out to God. And he looks at her and says, I think I see a drunk woman. He doesn't realize that this woman is actually calling out and crying out to God. But Eli has two worthless sons by the name of Hophni and Phinehas. You see a stark contrast between his sons and the son of Hannah in chapter 2. In fact, if you look at chapter 2, verse 17... you see that the writer is talking about Hophni and Phinehas, the sons of Eli. And it says in verse 17, thus the sin of the young men was very great in the sight of the Lord, for the men treated the offering of the Lord with contempt. They were unspiritual. They didn't do the job that they were supposed to. They didn't do exactly as God had commanded them to. But then look at the stark contrast to verse 18. So this is Hophni, this is Phinehas, this is the sons of Eli in verse 17. But then look how it carries into verse 18. It says, Samuel was ministering before the Lord, a boy clothed with the linen ephod. So while you have Eli, his sons, Hophni and Phinehas, doing wicked things here in verse 18, even as a young man, Samuel is serving the Lord faithfully. This would eventually lead to the house of Eli being devastated in chapter 2, verse 22, all the way through the end of the chapter. You go over to chapter 3, you end up seeing that this is a significant chapter for Samuel, because it's in chapter 3 that Samuel is actually called by God to be a prophet for Israel. In fact, he's laying in his bed and he hears God calling. He goes up to Eli. He says, I heard this voice speaking to me. You can see how sharp Eli actually is, because he's like, just go back to bed. It's nothing. Go back to bed. Happens three other times. So four times God calls Samuel in chapter 3. Only then does he realize that God is actually calling the boy Samuel. You go into chapter 4, you end up seeing that Israel is under attack by the Philistines. You see that they're actually being overtaken by the Philistines in chapter 4. The Ark of the Covenant is actually stolen from Israel. And when news gets to Eli that the ark has actually been stolen, this is actually really, really interesting. You see that the ark has been stolen. He gets word that his sons Hophni and Phinehas are actually dead. At that moment, Eli dies. Like, he falls over dead. Even more than that, Eli has this daughter-in-law that's actually the wife of Phinehas. And at this moment, when she sees her father-in-law die, she's pregnant. She bends over and gives birth in chapter 4. An incredibly graphic and wild chapter that you see happen in chapter 4, all because of this wickedness that's taking place. So you see the end of Eli's dynasty come to an end in chapter 4. The ark is eventually transferred from city to city. You see in chapter 4 that it goes from Ashdod to Gath to Ekron. In chapter 6, you see that the ark is actually brought back to Israel. That's an interesting story if you ever want to go read through that. The ways that it goes from city to city kind of blows you away. As the ark of God, this was the presence of God. And so you've got these ungodly and pagan cities grabbing this ark and having it in its presence. And it was causing nothing but wickedness and sickness for those people. And so these people were like, listen, get it out of my city. Take it somewhere else. I don't want it here. So that eventually leads to the Ark of the Covenant being back in Israel. In chapter 7, you see that he is made judge over all of Israel. This is Samuel. In fact, go over to chapter 7 and look at it's verse 1 or 2, I believe. Chapter 7. Actually, go to verse 3. Chapter 7, verse 3. And it says, "And Samuel said to all the house of Israel, if you're returning to the Lord with all your heart, then put away foreign gods, the Ashtaroth from among you, and direct your heart to the Lord and serve him only, and he will deliver you out of the hand of the Philistines." So the people of Israel put away the Baals, the Ashtaroth, and they served the Lord only. If you flip over to the end of this chapter, verse 15, it says, "Samuel judged Israel all the days of his life. And he went on a circuit year by year to Bethel, to Gilgal, to Mizpah, and he judged Israel in all these places. And then he would return to Ramah, for his home was there, and there also he judged Israel, and he built there an altar to the Lord." So here at the end of chapter 7, you end up seeing that Samuel is in this position that he is a breath of fresh air for Israel. They've had nothing but wicked judges before. Now you've got a guy that's going to judge, that's going to lead, that's going to direct in a godly way, a man full of wisdom, a man that has been prayed for even before his birth, a man that loves God, that loves his word, that wants to put these people in the right place before the Lord. This is Samuel. So let's go on to our second section, the rise and the downfall of Saul. So as I mentioned before, you see in chapters 1 through 7, this rise of Samuel kind of take place. But then in chapter 8, you end up seeing that we really get to the end of Samuel's life. You don't see a whole lot recorded about his entire ministry. In fact, you see in verse 1, it said, "When Samuel became old, he made his sons judges over Israel." So there's not a ton that's mentioned about Samuel. But going a little bit further, you see that in chapter 8, These men of Israel come before Samuel and they say, "Listen, your sons are not doing like they're supposed to. They're judges here. They're not doing the job that we need them to. In fact, we need someone that's going to do a better job for us. It's going to be king for us." They've looked at all these neighboring countries. They've looked at all these neighboring places. They've seen what these other people are doing. They're like, we need that. Bring to us what they have here. And so they, in chapters 9 and 10, you see that God actually anoints this man, Saul, to be king. Chapter 9, you end up seeing that this description of Saul. In fact, go to chapter 9, verse 1. Let's read this description of Saul together. It says in verse 1, "There was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish, the son of Abiel, son of Zeror, son of Becherath, son of Aphia, a Benjaminite, a man of wealth, and he had a son whose name was Saul." Now listen to the description of this man. "He was a handsome young man, and there was not a man among the people of Israel more handsome than he. From his shoulders upward, he was taller than any of the people." Now, I have to be honest. I don't know what that's like. Being a 5'7" man myself, I think that anyone above 6'1", 6'2", I mean, they're all the same. I look up to all of them. It seems like every student, I'm going to take a tangent here, it seems like every student in our student ministry is at least 6'3". And so being a guy that's, on a good day, maybe on a day that I'm wearing boots, 5'8", it makes me feel a little bit smaller. So I don't understand the problem that he has here. He's a tall man. He's head and shoulders above the rest. You end up seeing that he has wealth. He has everything. So looking on the outside, he's got exactly what you should have as king, as leader. You get into chapter 10, you see that he's actually anointed, and it seems for a quick minute that this man has initial success. In fact, if you go to chapter 10, verse 10, you see something pretty incredible. It says, actually, let's go to verse 9. It says, "When he turned his back to leave Samuel, God gave him another heart," talking about Saul, "and all these signs came to pass that day." And verse 10 says, "And when they came to Gibeah, behold, a group of prophets met him, and the Spirit of God rushed upon him, and he prophesied among him." And so here in chapter 10, it seems as if there's this initial success that comes to this person, Saul. He seems to be leading well, doing what he's supposed to be doing. But then as we get into chapter 13, go over to chapter 13 with me if you can, you end up seeing things begin to go sideways. So what starts out initially well doesn't end well. What starts as something good for this nation doesn't end as something that's good and helpful for this nation. In chapter 13, you end up seeing that he's fighting up against the Philistines like we talked about just a minute ago. He feels the pressure of the Philistines on his back. He's waiting for Samuel to come make this sacrifice before the Lord, and he ends up doing what he should not do. He, not the priest, he ends up making this sacrifice before God, and that's when Samuel comes up to him in verse 13 and says, listen, your kingdom will not remain. Listen to how God dealt with sin at that time. Didn't see much of a grace period there. Didn't see much of a time that grace was extended in that moment, to be quite honest. It was immediate. As soon as he disobeyed, as soon as there was rebellion, you see that God put an end to that. He said in chapter 13, your kingdom would not remain. You go over to chapter 14, things continue to go sideways. You see the train getting off of the tracks altogether for this man Saul. You see the Philistines kind of waging war up against the Israelites again. This will be this ongoing saga that happens over and over and over again all throughout the book of 1 Samuel. Chapter 14, you see Saul make this incredible rash vow. A vow that takes place that says, if someone eats before we defeat the Philistines, that person will die. Guess who eats before they defeat the Philistines? This is Jonathan, his son. He makes this rash vow. In chapter 15, we've talked about the battle with the Amalekites again, or a second ago. Again, you see him given direct orders from God to defeat and to wipe out altogether the Amalekites, to take away all the spoil, get rid of everything, leave nothing at all. And here in chapter 15, you see Saul doing what he wants to do, being disobedient, going his wayward way, choosing his own way, doing what is right in his own eyes. You see Samuel at the end of this chapter speak directly and harshly to Saul in verses 22 and 23. God has rejected you from being king because you've rejected his word. So all of this is this summation of this guy that wants to do what is right in his own eyes. He's been given direct orders from God, and yet he consistently does evil. You end up getting towards the end of this book, and you see that it only gets worse from there. So this is the rise and the downfall of Saul. You see him rise to his position, and then the gradual decline begins to happen. And as that decline begins to happen, you see someone kind of out of the middle of nowhere, this man David, kind of begin to rise on the scene. In fact, I think David will be one that Pastor will speak a little bit more in depth about next week in 2 Samuel. But you see him begin to rise to the surface in chapter 16. So roll over to chapter 16 with me if you can. Chapter 16, you see that after Saul has already been told that he will no longer, really like his kingship would not last, David is anointed king in verse 16. Samuel's looking for the guy. He ends up going to the house of Jesse. Verse 6 in chapter 16, it says, and when they came, he looked on Eliab, which was the son of Jesse, and he thought, surely the Lord's anointed is before him. Because he looked at Eliab, and he thought that Eliab was this tall guy, this strong leader, kind of reminded of him, Saul. And you have to think for yourself, you have to realize that didn't go well the first time. What makes you think it would go well the second time, right? Ultimately, that leads him down the line to this last son, the son of Jesse, that would be this smallest son that I can relate to in height and stature a little bit more than Saul. He's this guy that was shepherding sheep. He was this guy that was doing hard labor. He was this guy that didn't appear to be anything remotely like what a king would be. And God says, listen, that's the guy that I want. And so Samuel anoints this man, David, to be king. You see some crazy stories happen here in chapter 16. Saul is dealing with anger. He's dealing with crazy emotions. He's looking for someone to play the harp for him. Someone mentions that this guy Jesse has a son that plays. This guy Jesse that has a son that plays is actually David. And so it's David that's brought into the house of Saul, this man that would be anointed king, that's brought into the house of the current king. And whenever he would feel himself getting frustrated or angry, David would play the harp. And would soothe him. In chapter 17, you see one of the most famous stories and one of the most taken out of context stories in the Bible. You see David and Goliath. How many of you guys have heard sermons and lessons taught before about David and Goliath where you're inserted into the position of David fighting up against your Goliaths? That's not contextual at all, right? But here we find David fighting Goliath. In chapter 18, you've got the friendship of David and Saul that begins to come onto the surface. You begin to see David actually intermarry into the family of Saul, marrying the daughter of Saul. And then from chapters 18 all the way through chapters 26, you see this ongoing story, this cycle that continues to happen over and over again, where Saul is enraged in anger and jealousy. He's overwhelmed with, man, I want this guy out of this picture altogether. He sees that David is coming up behind him. He sees that he doesn't like this man, David. He wants to get rid of him altogether. And so over and over and over again, you see murder after attempted murder take place. There's one story in particular, if you go over to 1 Samuel chapter 24, you'll actually see in chapter 24 where David spares Saul's life. In fact, you see in the verse 1, it says, when Saul returned from following the Philistines, he was told, behold, David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi. And then Saul took 3,000 chosen men out of all Israel and went to seek David and his men in front of the wild goats' rocks. And he came to the sheepfold by the way where there was a cave, and Saul went in to relieve himself. Now listen to this. Now David and his men were sitting in the innermost parts of the cave, and the men of David said to him, here's the day of which the Lord said to you, behold, I will give your enemy into your hand, and you shall do to him as it shall seem good to you. And then David arose and stealthily cut off a corner of Saul's robe, and afterwards David's heart struck him because he had cut off a corner of Saul's robe. So you end up seeing that David and his men are hiding from Saul in this cave. They end up going to the innermost parts of the cave. Saul comes in to relieve himself, to take care of business. And while he's there, you've got David and his men that are sitting there. Saul has no idea that David and his men are back here. David comes up to Saul, cuts a corner of his robe off, kind of comes back and says, listen, I could have killed you, but I didn't. Shows you the heart of David versus the heart of Saul. If that would have been Saul, he would have easily taken the life of David. But here, over and over and over again, you see David extending forgiveness and kindness and grace to this person, Saul. You go to the end of chapter 28, you end up seeing that Saul is in this weird spot. He's in this place where things are silent from God altogether. God's not speaking to Saul. He's kind of done with him at this moment. The Philistines are coming up against the Israelites. Saul has cried out to God. He's asking God to give him wisdom, and God's not doing anything at that moment because of all the rebellion and sin. So Saul does something that he had already banned in Israel. He ends up going to this woman that's called a medium that we would look at and say, man, this is a woman that's practicing witchcraft. He disguises himself. He dresses up like somebody that he's not. He goes to this woman, and he wants to know what he should do. So he's kind of giving way to pagan practices. He's giving way to disobedience. He's giving way to following after the ways of the world. And here in chapter 28, this woman, our pastor would say that all along this woman has been a phony up until this moment. And then in this moment, this woman actually brings up Samuel, which has been dead. And there you see Samuel prophesying from the dead to this person, Saul, and telling him ultimately that the next day he would die and his kingdom would be done. You end up seeing that take place. You go to the end of the book, you see in chapter 31 that this prophecy is fulfilled. You end up seeing here, in fact, in verses 1 through 4, let me read this to you in chapter 31. It says, now the Philistines were fighting against Israel, and the men of Israel fled before the Philistines and fell slain on Mount Gilboa. And the Philistines overtook Saul and his sons, and the Philistines struck down Jonathan and Abinadab and Milchishua, the sons of Saul. The battle pressed hard against Saul. The archers found him, and he was badly wounded by the archers. So here at verse 3, pause here for a second. You see David, you see Saul and his sons. You see his sons have already been taken. Saul's been wounded. Verse 4 says, then Saul said to his armor bearer, draw your sword and thrust me through with it, lest these uncircumcised come and thrust me through and mistreat me. But his armor bearer wouldn't do it, for he feared greatly. Therefore, Saul took his own sword and fell on it. And when his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell upon his sword and died within him. So it says here that Saul and his three sons died in the same way that they were prophesied just the day before. Here at the end of this tragic life is this tragic death of Saul committing suicide. All the way to the end of his life, continued to rebel, continued to walk in disobedience, continued to live a life of rebellion against God. So you look back to the whole book and you see that there is moment after moment of heartache, moment after moment of tragedy, moment after moment of disappointment. You see all kinds of terrible things happening here in this book. But just because you see all the hardship and all the difficulty, don't let that discourage you from seeing the glimmer of hope. Chapter 16 that will lead us all the way through the end of 2 Samuel, you see David. And he's going to bring stability, he's going to bring health, he's going to bring help to the people of Israel, and even more, he's going to point us to the person of Jesus that would be the better and more full version of David. He would be the ultimate king that would bring salvation through his finished work. So that's the summary of 1 Samuel, chapter 1 all the way through chapter 31. Let's go back just a little bit more and talk just a little bit about these characters that we see. All the way back to chapter 1. Let's focus a little bit. Let's try to zone in a little bit on the main characters that we see leading us through this book of 1 Samuel. The first person that you see is Hannah that's on the scene. What you end up seeing first is that this woman, Hannah, her name actually means woman of grace. Names were significant in this time. Names meant something during this time. She was a woman of grace. And as you look at her life in chapters 1 and chapters 2, you can absolutely see that. What I want you to see first about Hannah, though, is that she was a woman that had experienced personal suffering. She experienced personal suffering. Look at verse 2. You're introduced to Hannah. He says, he had two wives, talking about Elkanah, the husband. The name of the one was Hannah. The name of the other was Peninnah. Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. Here at the end of verse 2, you see that she's barren. She's unable to have kids. This was something that weighed heavy on her. This was something that she pleaded with before the Lord. This was something that she did not like, something that she consistently brought before the Lord. But that's not the only extent of her suffering. If you look at verse 6, it says that she experienced another type of suffering. It says in verse 6, and it says, and her rival, talking about Peninnah, used to provoke her grievously to irritate her, because the Lord had closed her womb. So not only is this woman barren, she's also experiencing all of this ridicule from the woman that was Elkanah's other wife. She was experiencing being made fun of. She was experiencing hardship. She was experiencing difficulty and suffering. Now, I want you to pause here for a second and think about this. Your suffering may not look like Hannah's suffering. You may not look like Hannah in every detail. You may not be barren like Hannah. You may not have the type of ridicule that she's experiencing, but in some way, you have experienced suffering in your life. So you can align yourself in some way with how she feels in this moment. We would say, Elizabeth Elliot would actually define suffering and say that suffering is not having what you want and then having something that you don't want. So you can make that as big or as small as you want to, whether it's a cancer diagnosis or maybe just a bad grade in a class for a student. Suffering is having something that you don't want or not having what you do want. And here, she wants a child and she can't have a child. And so in her distress, she feels suffering. But she doesn't allow her suffering to simply end there. She doesn't just like sulk in her suffering, but she does something with it. You see in verses 10 and 11 that she's not only experiencing suffering, but she was a woman of earnest prayer. Look at verses 10 and 11. Verse 10 says, and she was deeply distressed, and she prayed to the Lord and wept bitterly. She vowed a vow, and she said, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your servant and remember me and not forget your servant, but will give to your servant a son, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall touch his head. She is a woman of deep and earnest prayer. Think about your own life for a second. When those moments of suffering enter into your life, when you feel moments of deep distress, when you feel moments of discouragement, what is your first response? Should be just like Hannah, taking it immediately before the Lord. 1 Peter chapter 5, casting all of your anxieties on God because he cares for you. This is what Hannah did. So not only was she a woman of earnest prayer, you also see that she was faithful to her words. At the end of chapter 1, verses 27 and 28, she says, "For this child I prayed, and the Lord has granted me my petition that I made to him. Therefore, I have lent him to the Lord. As long as the Lord lives, he is lent to the Lord." And he worshiped the Lord there. So not only does she make this vow to God, not only does she say that I'm going to give this child back to you, she says it, but then she does it in verses 27 and 28. She recognizes that children are a gift from God to be given back to God. As parents, that's our job, that's our role. We may raise our children in our homes, we raise them and teach them the gospel, but we give those children back to God, just as Hannah had given her children back to the Lord. They were dedicated to Christ to do what he desired to do with him. So that's Hannah, which leads us into the second person that we see, this person, Eli. We see him in chapters 1 through 4. We've already said before, but he is spiritually dull. Okay, he's a priest. He's someone that is to be interceding on behalf of Israel. But he is, as Pastor would say, just like I said a little bit ago, he's as sharp as a marble. He's looking at this woman pray. He's looking at this woman pray, not understanding exactly what she's doing. He thinks that she's drunk. That he's spiritually delayed. So we see that he's spiritually dull, but we also see, too, that he's not a spiritual leader. In fact, if you look at chapter 2, verse 12, it says here that these sons that he had, Hophni and Phinehas, these were worthless sons. It says, "Now the sons of Eli, they were worthless men. They did not know the Lord." And it goes on to talk about how wicked they were. You end up seeing later on in the chapter that he is to call out these sons and to tell them to walk rightly before the Lord, but Eli fails to do so. So even though he's been given command and charge by God to speak directly to his children and to do something about their leadership, he fails to follow through. He's not a strong leader. That leads us to the third person that we'll look at, this person, Samuel. Samuel, the word Samuel itself actually means God hears. So you see, even in the name Samuel, that God is answering prayer. You see that he is one that is prayed for before he's actually even arrived on the scene. In chapter 1, verse 10, Hannah is crying out to God for her son that's yet to be born. You see in chapter 2 that he's serving the Lord faithfully, contrasting up against the sons of Eli, Hophni, and Phinehas, which are doing wickedness. You see in chapter 3 that he's chosen by God, he's selected by God to serve as prophet. You see in chapter 7 in verses 3 and 4 that he's a man of conviction. He's a man that's got steel in his backbone that says, "I'm going to do what God says. Get away from your idols, get away from your wickedness, and follow after God." He's standing up to wickedness. He's a man of prayer in chapter 8, verse 6. You've got the men of Israel that come before Samuel that say, "Listen, we want this king." He cries out to God. Chapter 15, verses 10 and 11, you see that he's again crying out to God on behalf of Saul. In fact, roll over to chapter 15 if you can. I want you to see this. Chapter 15, verses 10 and 11. It says in verse 10, "The word of the Lord came to Samuel." This is after Saul has completely disobeyed God's orders. "I regret that I have made Saul king, for he's turned his back from following me, and he's not performed my commandments." And Samuel's response, he was angry, and he cried out to the Lord. So here, in response to getting this news that Saul was doing these wicked things, he cries out to God. Even though Samuel knew that Saul was doing wickedly, he cries out to the Lord on behalf of Saul and his people. He's a man of prayer. You see in chapter 8, verse 10, that he does hard things. He's honest with Saul. When he has to stand up and be bold and say that Saul is getting out of line, he does hard things. In chapter 15, verses 17 through 23, you see that he speaks to Saul and says that he was going to be rejected. You get to the end of chapter 15. Yeah, I think you're actually in chapter 15. Stay there for a second. He does hard things here at the end of chapter 15. After you see that he kind of lays out to Saul that he would no longer be king. In verse 32, he has to come along and clean up Saul's mess with the Amalekites, where Saul was keeping all of the spoil for himself and didn't kill the king Agag. In verse 32, it says, "Then Samuel said, 'Bring here to me Agag, the king of the Amalekites.' And Agag came to him cheerfully. So here's Agag coming to Samuel cheerfully, gladly. And Agag said, "Surely the bitterness of death is past." And Samuel said, "As your sword has made women childless, so shall your mother be childless among women." And Samuel hacked Agag to pieces before the Lord in Gilgal. I don't know what that looked like. I don't want to see what that looked like. But here you see Samuel doing some savage things because he is a man that has steel in his backbone. His commitment and faithfulness to God supersedes anything else that he's committed to. He wants to do God's things, God's ways. So he does hard things. Leads us into the next person, this person, Saul. I've looked at Saul just a little bit. Chapter 9, verse 1, you see that he was a man that had a pedigree. He was a man that had some credentials behind his name. He was a man of wealth. He was a man that was handsome. He was anointed king. He had everything going for him that was right. He had a name. He had something to kind of be looked at and emulated. And he also had the appearance of spiritual success at first. So even though he started with spiritual success at first, it seemed he didn't finish that way. So he had a pedigree. He had the appearance of success. You also see in chapter 13, verses 8, that he was impatient. He offered that unlawful sacrifice. He took matters into his own hands. He didn't wait on God's timing. He was impatient. You see that he was disobedient to God's commands all throughout the book of 1 Samuel. In chapter 13, the sacrifice. In chapter 15, the war with the Amalekites. In chapter 18 through 26, the ongoing saga of wanting to kill and murder David. In chapter 28, the conversation with this woman that was practicing witchcraft, this medium. You see that he was disobedient to God's commands. But then lastly, you see that he was hopeless. He was hopeless. All throughout his reign, he was looking for something to justify him. He was looking to make his name great. He was looking to do all kinds of things to make him look good, to make his reputation high and lofty. But at the end of chapter 13, you see that he was absolutely hopeless to the point that he would take his own life. That leads us to the next person that we'll talk about. In fact, I think that we'll pick up in in 2 Samuel, talking about this person, David, next week. So even though David is on the scene here in 1 Samuel, you end up seeing that he really only serves the purpose as a minor character now. As you get towards the end of the book and get into 2 Samuel, you end up seeing that he's going to play more of a prominent role. So we'll leave his description for next week. But I want to leave you with a couple of practical application points as we look at this whole book all together. First application point is this, that God is sovereign. That God is sovereign. We talked about this a little bit ago, but it's the idea that there's not anything on the face of the earth that is not governed and controlled by God alone. We see in Proverbs chapter 21, verse 21, that God even, he steers the hearts of the kings and has them do whatever he desires them to do. So even among the wicked, God is sovereign. God is fully in control. He's the one that created all things. He's the one that put all things in existence. And he is the one that governs all things. So as you see all of the transitions happen, as you see all of the wars take place, as you see all the wickedness that's here, you can't help but see that God is working to bring something about that would point us to Christ. But not only is God sovereign, looking and ruling, you also see that God is personal. That God is personal, meaning that God is involved in the details. From listening to Hannah's prayer to all the way through the putting in place of Samuel to all the way through the entire book of 1 Samuel, you see that God is personal. He's involved in the details. It's easy to think that just because God is sovereign, that he's reigning as king over all things, it's easy to think that he's not involved in the intricacies of your life, but he absolutely is. Simply look at 1 Samuel. He's personal. You see that God answers prayer. You see that he's sovereign. You see that he's personal. You see that he answers prayer. Here's this woman in chapter 1 that really serves for us the purpose of being this woman figure that we look to and say, man, she is the godly example of what a mother should be. She's crying out to the Lord consistently for having a child. She wants a child. She cries out to God out of deep distress. And what does God do? God answers prayer. He listens, hears, and he acts. He answers prayer. You see also that God is holy. You see that God is holy. And you see this by him not tolerating any sin at all, right? It doesn't take any moment at all before you see God's judgment reigning. In chapter 13, where this unlawful sacrifice happens on Saul's behalf, Saul is doing this unlawful sacrifice. You see that instantly word is spoken to Saul that you shall no longer reign. In chapter 15, when he's disobedient with the Amalekites, you see that his kingship will be taken from him. In chapter 28, there's this prophecy that says your kingship will be done. In fact, you're going to die tomorrow. There is little tolerance for sin. There's no tolerance for sin. God is holy. But then lastly, you see that as you bring things to a conclusion, there's absolutely nothing new under the sun. So even though we look at this book as something that was written years and years ago, it doesn't take long at all to see that this really serves as a mirror to point us to where we are today. There's wickedness that's around. There's hardship that's around. There's suffering that's around. There's political strife that's around. All kind of difficulty that's present here. But in the midst of all that, we also need to see that in the same way that there was chaos, in the same way that there was difficulty, there was hope that was coming. For you and I, in the midst of our chaos, we have hope, and that person is Jesus. So even though we see that this book is something that was years and years ago written, it's something that's very applicable, very relevant, that points us to Christ even today. That's 1 Samuel, guys. It seems like I've been talking for 5 minutes, but it's been an hour, which is crazy. So I want to pray for you. I want to get you out of here on time so you can get home before the weather gets any worse. But thank you for your patience. Next week, you'll look at 2 Samuel, and you'll have Pastor back with you. So let's pray. We'll wrap up. Father, thank you for tonight. We thank you for your word that you give us that's incredible. And Lord, we look at this book of 1 Samuel. We see that all throughout this book, there's story after story. There's heartache after heartache. But in all of that, we have to recognize, Father, that there's nothing new that's under the sun. All of this is present today. And just as there was hope in the person of David, Lord, there's hope in the person of Jesus. And I pray that we would grab that personally even today. Thank you for your word. Thank you for the beauty of it. Would you guide us by your grace? We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.